Please take your Bibles and turn to the book of Ecclesiastes, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, I will begin reading in verse 1 down to verse 14. Ecclesiastes 7, beginning at verse 1. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fools. This also is vanity. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning. And the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money. And the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. And in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. No. In fact, what does the Bible tell us about Job? What kind of a man was he? He was a righteous man. Did bad things happen to Job? Yes, very bad things, right? One of the mistakes that we seem to carry into our Christianity is the idea that God works on a kind of one-to-one basis. In other words, for every one bad thing I do, one bad thing is going to happen to me from the hand of God. For every one good thing I do, God is now under some obligation to give me one good thing in my life. So if I live a good life, my life will be full of blessing and prosperity. And if I live a bad life, my life will be full of cursing and adversity. Do you remember the story in the Gospel of John when a blind man approached Jesus, and the text in John makes it clear that this man had been blind how long? From birth. And the question asked by the disciples to Jesus was what? Who has sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And how does Jesus answer them? Neither. But, what's that? It was for the purposes of the Father that this man had been born blind. He had done nothing good nor bad to warrant the blindness, but God, in His sovereign purposes, had this man to be blind. So you have a man who is blind, you have a man like Job, you have Asaph, the psalmist, in Psalm 73, as he considers the wicked. Their eye bulges with fatness. They have necklaces of pride around their necks. They are prosperous. And Asaph is what? Envious. Why such prosperity for the wicked when we are suffering? You should read Psalm 73. I know I've said it before, but I think North Americans ought to read it all the time. You live in a world and in a culture where you are constantly being told to be envious of what everybody else has. Because if I can get you envious, then you'll buy that car you don't need, or that new the new clothes you don't need, or whatever the case may be. In order to keep the mighty economic machine rolling, we've got to get you envious for what you don't really need. So read Psalm 73. The end of the psalm, the psalmist says, "If I had gone and spoken this, I would have betrayed your people." For he realizes that some experience prosperity who are evil men. Some experience prosperity who are righteous men. Some experience great adversity who are evil men. Some experience adversity who are righteous men. In other words, prosperity and adversity is not related to how well you live your life. Now, there is a certain principle. If you live your life in flagrant sin and disobedience, and you're shooting up with drugs all the time and doing things you should not be doing, that your life will be difficult. There is fruit to sin, isn't there? But a good person can experience great adversity. And rotten people can experience great prosperity. So, we need to understand why. And that's what Solomon is teaching us here in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. From chapter 6 to chapter 8 and verse 15, it's one big section out of the four big sections of the book. And in this big section, that's what we find ourselves in. Solomon is teaching this. A wise person learns to look at life through God's wisdom. He focuses on God and obeying God. And he enjoys the gifts that God sovereignly gives. I know that's a big encompassing statement, but that's the heart of what Solomon says here in chapter 6, 7, and half of chapter 18 in Ecclesiastes. The wise person is one who looks at life with God's wisdom. Part of that then is focusing on obeying God regardless of circumstances, and then enjoying the good things that God gives when He gives them. Now, Solomon has been giving some practical application. And from chapter 6, verse 1, down to chapter 7, verse 14, you could sum up this section this way. What you see is not always what you get. What you see is not always what you get. In other words, Solomon says, as Christians, as wise people, we need to learn to evaluate outward fortunes in light of divine providence. We've got to learn to evaluate people's outward fortunes, including our own, our outward fortune or misfortune, if you like, in light of divine providence, not just the circumstances. And that means, kids, that when things are going really well, we need to see that as from the Lord. And when things are going quite difficultly, we need to see that as from the Lord. And we need to seek the Lord in the midst of both of those times. Now, we saw a couple of weeks ago, I don't know, when's the last time I preached here? Whenever that was, that prosperity is not necessarily good. Remember that? Wealth. Not necessarily a good thing if you have no what? Do you remember? If you have no ability to enjoy it. Great wealth, no ability to enjoy it, that's an evil. This is what Solomon says, chapter 6, verses 1 to 6. And then in verses 7 through 9 of chapter 6, he says, you might have an industriousness, an ability to work, to get much accomplished, but if you have an ability to work with an appetite that is never satisfied, that's an evil too. Because you'll just work and work and work and never be satisfied, never be satisfied, never be satisfied. There's no joy. Thirdly, he says, to have great intelligence so that you ponder the questions of life, but to have no answers to those questions. This too is an evil. Think of all the philosophers you read who committed suicide. There's at least a few. They pondered the right questions, but they couldn't find the right answers. It is an evil to have intelligence with no real answers. So Solomon says, wealth, the ability to work, great intelligence, these things are all signs of prosperity, but they're not necessarily good. What's good then? Well, he'll tell us in chapter 7. That's what we'll look at tonight. Really, what Solomon says is this: sometimes adversity is good. Sometimes adversity is good. Adversity is good when you are weight training. Do we have any weight trainers here? You want adversity. You want negative pressure on your limbs. You want resistance. And as you work against the weight, you are, through that resistance, strengthening the muscle. Adversity and affliction are not always, are not necessarily a bad thing, because they can function like a weight in weight training. They will strengthen you as you walk in the grace of the Lord. So let's see what Solomon says here. Death, sorrow, afflictions, funerals, rebukes, they're not all bad. Now, these are the things that are often viewed as the worst thing that can happen to you. I mean, death. Some people dread going to a funeral. Affliction, trouble, the rebuke of a friend. We can look at these things and say, these are the worst things that could happen to me. Solomon looks at these and say, you know what, those may be better than wealth, the ability to work, and intelligence. So to the wise, or for the godly, what is good? Number one, the first good thing Solomon says here. It's interesting, right? He says in verse 12 of chapter 6, for who knows what is good for a man while he lives a few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow. For who can tell a man what will come after him under the sun? And then the next verse, a good name. And then the better phrases. Verse 2, better to go to the house of mourning. Verse 3, sorrow is better. Verse 5, it's better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise. Verse 8, better is the end of a thing than its beginning. So Solomon is answering the question, who can tell a man what is good? Here's what's good. Death. Death is a good thing. Why? Two reasons. It authenticates the godly, and it sobers the silly. First of all, death authenticates the godly. I couldn't think of a better word than this, but I think this is what Solomon is getting at here. He says this, a good name is better than precious ointment. A good name. What's a good name? What does that mean? How would you describe that little phrase today? To have a good name. Good, you're bang on. That's what it means. A good reputation. So a good name is better than precious ointment. A reputation, I heard one time, and it stuck in my little brain, takes a lifetime to build and a moment to lose. Right? It takes a lifetime to build a good reputation, one bad choice to ruin it. Solomon says a good name is better than precious ointment, like a perfume. And it's something which is valuable, and you can picture it like as Jesus let the woman break the alabaster vial and pour it on his feet and on his head and anoint him. There is this picture of the aroma filling the room. It is a precious perfume, a precious ointment. And I think what Solomon is saying here is something like this. In the time of death, if one has had a good reputation, then his reputation fills the room, as it were. It validates a life that is well lived. What is better for a man than to have lived his whole life faithfully to the end? At our men's meeting last year, we looked at the kings and how many of the kings, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, how many of these guys were good for a while and then crashed at the end. And they weren't buried with the kings. Oh, to be buried with the kings. That's what we want. We want to be buried with the kings. We want to be buried in the place of honor. We want our name to go on after us like a sweet-smelling perfume, so that should God take us young or should He call us when we are old, we die with a good name. Solomon says, the day of death is better than the day of birth. Why? Is that despair? I don't think so. I think what he's saying is this: when you're born, you're a nothing blob. You're a blob, right? You're a cute blob, and everybody loves the blob, and they touch the blob, and they rub the blob's head. You ever notice that with babies? People rub their heads. I rubbed little Michaela Challey's head today, and I thought, why am I doing that? I don't know. It's what you do with a baby. You rub the head. Am I the only person who rubs heads? Apparently. Well, they're a blob. They're great. I mean, fantastic, but they can't do anything. All they can do is say, feed me, change me, sleep me. And that's their life. But a man who has lived his life and he has grown in wisdom and he's grown in understanding, who's done the kind of things that Solomon's already talked about having the right word at the right time and living a life of integrity and finding joy in the things that God gives. When that man dies, his good reputation wafts through the room like a sweet-smelling perfume. Better is his day of death than his day of birth. So death authenticates the godly. This man died in Christ. Secondly, death sobers the silly. I got a phone call once about 7 years ago. Family in the church I pastored said to me, could you do this funeral? My 29-year-old nephew took his own life. I went and I visited with the family. It was obvious that they were of a kind of the biker party crowd, very hard-edged, no Christ present in this side of the family. Everybody wanted to have a good time. Everybody looking for life in parties and drinking, in rampant, illicit, bad sin. But the day of the funeral came, and there were over 200 of them crammed into this country chapel. This man had died in his sins, took his own life. But it was silent in the room. As I could look in eyes all across the room and say, what of you? Have you turned to Christ? Are you going to live your life in frivolity, in silliness, in partying? You didn't know the turmoil that your friend was in. People, you're all shocked. What turmoil are you in your heart of hearts? I tell you, what a great joy to preach Christ in the midst of that. That's exactly what Solomon says here. It's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Jonathan Edwards, I told you before, his resolution: I resolve daily to think upon the circumstances and the time of my death, so that I might be prepared to meet my God in the moment He should call me. To daily think about your day of death. Children, one day you will die. You may be old. You may not be. We need to think about the day of our death, when we will stand before the Lord who sees all that we have done, the Lord who will call us into account? And are we ready to stand before that God? The living, lay it to heart. That's what Solomon says. Because it's the end of all mankind. I'll be quite honest with you. I love to preach at funerals. Because suddenly everything makes crystal clear sense. 10 out of 10 people die. And now you can't hide from it anymore, because here's his corpse. And so what of you? The living lay it to heart. So death authenticates the godly. It sobers the silly. So even though we may view death as a bad thing, Solomon can look and say, you know what? The adversity of death is not such a bad thing. For the one who has walked with God, he's authenticated. And for those who are left behind, they're called to account. Death is not such a bad thing. Secondly, sorrow. Verse 3. Sorrow is better than laughter. For by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. What does mirth mean? It's not a word we use a lot. Somebody define mirth for me. It's not a little foam ball. It's not a little blue creature with a white hat. Smurf. What is mirth? Anybody know? Will? Oh, Murphy's the dog, that's right. Yeah. Murphy the dog. That's mirth. We're talking about mirth. I don't know. What does mirth mean? Victor.
Pleasure.
What kind of pleasure?
Bad
pleasure. Bad pleasure, yeah. Mirth, the way that I think Solomon is using it here, is frivolity. Silliness. Looking for life in happiness, doing crazy things to try and take your mind off of reality. Laughter and mirth are not the best thing. The heart of fools is in the house of mirth. Sorrow is better than laughter. Why? The wise are in the house of mourning. And now look what Solomon says. For by sadness of face, the heart is made glad. What does that mean? By sadness of face, the heart is made glad. Any guesses? Nice and loud.
I think it might happen.
All right. Any other takers? Jimmy?
It seems like it brings things personally to a more honest level. When you're seeking mirth, I mean, I think of mirth like you watch a comedy routine. It's like there's no depth to it. You're just kind of ha ha ha, that's funny. Like it doesn't it's not touching anything inside. And you know, when you let that exterior, that level, you let that be sober, then your heart's allowed to be more honest with the way things are. And so you have a more, you know, yeah, you have a sober exterior because there are, you know, you do see reality, but then there's a little bit of comfort there. There's a little bit of, you know, for the Christian, there's a peace there.
Anyone else? I got no idea what it means. Well, I have a guess. Luther said this in his translation of these words: "The heart is made better by sorrow." He said it in German, but I don't know German. The heart is made better by sorrow. And so he took that, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The idea that sorrow does a work. Godly sorrow does a work. Paul said something about that with repentance, didn't he? There's a godly sorrow in repentance, and it does a work. It does a good thing. And I think it's all of these ideas that you've said as well, that not that we are to be gloomy and wear a burqa and throw ashes in the air every day of our lives, but sorrow is better than laughter in the sense when sorrow does its work. And when sorrow does its work, it makes the heart better. Laughter, frivolity, mirth, has as its goal to deny, right? You're looking for an escape. You flip on the comedy channel because you want to escape. You want to get out of life. You want to feel better. You're looking for an artificial stimulus to try and bring a kind of joy. But there is no joy in those things. I mean, you might chuckle for a while, but it cannot address, as Jimmy said, your heart issues. And so the person who is constantly seeking life in comedy and in frivolity and in silliness and in mirth is, in Solomon's word, a fool. Have you known people like this? Who are just running from one thing to another, trying to be entertained, trying to be giddy, trying to be funny, can't ever be serious about anything. And they are cheating themselves. And they're missing the Lord. Elizabeth Prentice, in her hymn, said this: "Let sorrow do its work. Come grief or pain, sweet are thy messengers, sweet their refrain, when they can sing with me more love, O Christ, to thee." Let them do their work, grief or pain. So death, the adversity of death, can be a good thing. The adversity of sorrow can be a good thing. Let's look at a third very quickly. The adversity of being rebuked. Verse 5. "It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fools. This also is vanity. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart." The songs of fools don't help. Just listen to pop music. I've been into this lately. I don't know why. I just keep down or reading lyrics of songs because it's funny to me. If you take the lyrics of a song out of its music, you see how dumb they are sometimes. They're just dumb. "I saw you and you saw me, and then we stood under an apple tree. Yeah, yeah, yeah." Like, it's just, it's nothing. It's absolute nothingness. The songs of the fools are crackling of thorns under a pot. In the Hebrew, it rhymes. You can't rhyme it in English, but it's like the nettles under the kettles are crackling. I mean, it's just, he's mocking, really, in his poetry. Look over for a moment at Proverbs chapter 17, verse 10. 17:10 of Proverbs. "A rebuke goes deeper into a man of understanding than 100 blows into a fool." Some of you have had dogs like this. You say to the dog, "Bad dog," and the dog is devastated. Tail between the legs. "Oh, I promise I'll never do it again." There's the other dog. He's just, "Bad dog." He's like, you pound on your dog and he's still, he's a dumb dog. He's a fool. Solomon says, "A rebuke goes deeper into a man of understanding, one rebuke, than 100 blows into a fool." You can smack him all you like, but he ain't ever going to learn. He's a fool. The wise man listens to rebuke. Proverbs chapter 9, verse 8. Chapter 9, verse 8. Do not reprove a scoffer, or he will hate you. Go to a fool and reprove him for his sin, and he'll just hate you. Why are you telling me about that? What about you? Reprove a wise man, and he will love you. And give instruction to a wise man, and he will be still wiser. Teach a righteous man, and he will increase in learning. Are you wise or are you a fool? Do you welcome rebuke or do you turn it away? Children, when your parents rebuke you, do you listen? When they say, this is wrong and this is how to live? Or inside, do you get very angry? The wise man listens to rebuke. Look over at Proverbs 27, verse 6. Familiar to many of us. 27, verse 6. Faithful are the wounds of what? Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Profuse are the kisses of an enemy. What does that mean? Anyone? Ev? Sorry, a little louder. Fan noise. Good. Better to be reproved by someone who loves you than to be flattered by someone who doesn't. Anything else in that proverb? So it goes both ways, right? As a recipient, we'd much rather have rebuke than false kisses. And as the active agent in the relationship, we need to be willing to give rebuke and not just false kisses. You could look at Psalm 141, verse 5 and 6 and 7 or so and see the same kind of thing. But I want to take you back to Ecclesiastes again. It's better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fools. This is vanity. And so in our love, we need to learn how to speak the truth in love to one another and address sin in one another, because the cackling of fools and oppression and bribery, these things are madness and folly. There is a fourth. Death authenticates the godly and sobers the silly. Sorrow brings joy. The rebukes make wise. And fourthly, affliction teaches patience and proves wisdom. Affliction teaches patience and proves wisdom. Verse 8, better is the end of a thing than its beginning. How come? Why is the end better than the beginning?
Because hopefully you have endured the trial. You have proven yourself faithful.
Good. Anyone else? Why is the end better than the beginning? I think because it's over. Think about this for a minute. The end is better than the beginning because it's over. Whatever it is. You know the results. You do not have to be anxious anymore. You've lived through it. As Anna said, hopefully you've been faithful through it. So Solomon says, the end of a thing is better than the beginning. And the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun, for the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. The end is better than the beginning because it's over. And in the midst of a thing, in the midst of a matter, it can be very difficult. First of all, you need to be patient. Verse 8, the second part of the verse. The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. It can be difficult at the beginning of a matter to be patient to the end. And so the end is better than the beginning because it's over. Secondly, don't get angry in the middle of it. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. But at the very beginning of something, you may be a little bit stressed out, or things may be going wrong in the middle of it, and it is a temptation to be angry. So, it's better when you're at the end, because it's over. Thirdly, in the middle of something, you can start yearning for the past. Bruce Springsteen, Glory Days. I had a friend who was a big baseball player back in high school. He could throw that speedball by you, make you look like a fool, boy. Saw him the other night at this roadside bar. I was walking in, he was walking out. We went back inside, sat down, had a few drinks, but all he kept talking about was, do you know the song? Nobody's a friend of the, nobody likes the boss? Glory Days. Well, they'll pass you by. Glory Days in the wink of a young girl's eye. Glory Days. Well, there's a girl that lives up the block back in school. She could turn all the boys' heads. Sometimes on a Friday, I'll stop by and have a few drinks after she puts her kid to bed. Her and her husband, Bobby, well, they split up. I guess it's 2 years gone by now. We just sit around talking about the old times. She says when she feels like crying, she starts laughing, thinking about Glory Days. They'll pass you by. Glory Days in the wink of a young girl's eye. Glory Days. My old man worked 20 years on the line and they let him go. Now everywhere he goes out looking for work, they just tell him that he's too old. I was 9 years old and he was working at the Matukin Ford plant assembly line. Now he just sits on a stool down at the Legion Hall. The Legion. But I can tell what's on his mind. Glory Days. Yeah, going back. Glory Days. I ain't never had Glory Days. Oh boy. Have you met people that live in the past? Don't they say something like this? The former days were so much better than today. Solomon says, it's not wise. Don't say in the middle of the thing, oh, if only we could be back in this time. I tell you, back in my day, boy, whew, things were she. Don't go there. So the temptation is the beginning of a matter to get impatient, to get angry, to start yearning for the past. Fourthly, to be a fool. Verses 11 and 12. Oh, you need wisdom in the middle of something. Wisdom's good with an inheritance. An advantage to those who see the sun, for the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money. And the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. So you've got to be wise in the middle of something. So Solomon says the end of a matter is better than the beginning because it is over. And you're on to the next thing. So affliction's not necessarily a bad thing. What is the great conclusion? Verses 13 and 14. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? What does that mean? The king's heart is like channels of water. What's the rest?
I missed the first part of what you said. King's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. It directs it wherever it pleases.
King's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He directs it wherever he pleases. Look again at verse 13. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what He has made crooked? God has a path for you. Just went that way. Oh, now it went this way. Oh, it went back this way. And now this way. Have you ever seen a Bible map that traces out the wanderings of Israel? It's quite remarkable. 40 years. All around. Doing circles. Sometimes you stay in one place for a couple of years. The next time you pack up, you move, you stay here, then you're up and you move again. What? Why is the Lord doing that? There's a lot of reasons. But I think part of it is a picture of your life too. Not that your life is a wandering in the wilderness, but God is directing your path. He's taking you to Calgary. He's bringing you to Toronto. He's moving you here. He's moving you there. And in His plan, He has a purpose in all of it. Who can make straight what the Lord has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, if your path includes prosperity, be joyful. It's good to enjoy your prosperity. God has given you these things. Rejoice in your lot. And in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other. He's made the day of prosperity. He's made the day of adversity, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. Who is sovereign? Thank you. Scaring me here. The Lord is sovereign, and He directs our path. Prosperous path, rejoice in God. Adversity in your path, God made that one too. Rejoice in your lot and wait upon your God. Any closing thoughts from you?